was Louie Louie finishing the program. A band from about almost 10 years ago, featuring the great Emily Robb. We heard Hang It Up from Friend of a Stranger. Norberto Lobo before that, Figuera from Estrella. Joseph Jarman from 1968 says, If It Were the Seasons, we heard Song to Make the Sun Come Up. Mike Stevens, Welsh guitarist and singer, doing Roedd Gennyf I Gariad, I Had a Love. Alto Jeffro, before that, from the Unknown Cowboy LP, we heard the self-titled track. Laurel Meets the Obsolete did These Days, not those days, but These Days, from On Welfare. And Bill Callahan at the top of the set, doing Every Way from the live record Resuscitate. My name is Scott. Thank you for listening today. I look forward to seeing you friends next week on Freeform Radio, WFMU, in East Orange, WMFU in Mount Hope in New York City and Rockland County at 91.9 FM, worldwide online at WFMU.org. Stay tuned. Station manager Ken filling in for Mark Hurst's Tectonic. He'll be speaking with David Sussman about war and music. Bye.
Welcome to Tectonic. Tonight, a very special episode of Tectonic. This is station manager Ken filling in for Mark Hurst. And tonight, I'm very happy to welcome back to the airwaves a WFMU DJ, David Sussman, who is also a history professor at the University of Delaware. And we're talking about his brand new book, Instrument of War, Music and the Making of America's Soldiers. David, welcome to Tectonic.
Thanks, Ken. It's great to be here.
And why did you write this book? It's a very interesting subject, music and the military. What led you to write this?
Well, I'll tell you two ways that I got here. One was that I was doing some research for another project on sonic weapons. I was really interested to see what the history of sonic weapons in the military might be. And so I dug into that. And I actually found there wasn't that much there. There wasn't as much history to sonic weapons as I was hoping there would be. But in the course of that work, I kept coming across all of this music in the military. And so I started to get curious about that.
When you say sonic weapons, are you referring to the media stories that we read about certain songs being used, you know, to blast at high volume as some kind of form of audio torture?
Yeah, I mean, it's that, or it was, I was interested in like the using music to blast at, or just sound as a way of intimidating soldiers. And there were some experiments back in World War II, as going back as far as World War II, but they didn't amount to that much. And there was a bit more in Vietnam, but it didn't really take. So, I mean, the military's, they've got a big research and development budget, so they'll try anything. So it didn't really, you know, get any purchase, but I did come across a lot of music in the course of working on that. And I just sort of got thinking about how much music in the military I was already aware of, thinking about, buglers blowing reveille or the soldiers chanting during basic training or whatever, armed forces radio, all this stuff that I kind of had in my head already, but I couldn't quite put it together, and nobody else had kind of connected it. And so it seemed to me like this was actually a substantive subject that was kind of hiding in plain sight. Nobody had really kind of connected all these pieces, although evidently there was a lot of music in the military that nobody was really talking about.
And what is the scope of military music? You have some incredible statistics in the book, which I think you said that the American military is the largest employer of musicians in the world.
Yes, it is single largest employer of musicians in the world. I opened the book with a statistic that I came across when I was doing my research that kind of stopped me in my tracks. In 2015, the Congress allocated about $437 million for music in the military, which was nearly three times the budget of the National Endowment for the Arts, the whole National Endowment for the Arts. And I was just kind of floored by that, just thinking about how much of an investment the government was making in this kind of music, which is and not, all the other arts combined didn't even register. So th this is the just the kind of music that the military itself was making, like military bands and stuff. But the scope of the book actually is broader than that, in the sense that I'm interested in both what music meant for the military as an institution, like military bands or whatever, but also what soldiers themselves did with music. So soldiers singing informally for fun is also within the scope of the book, or listening to iPods that soldiers brought with them themselves to Iraq, for example. That's not covered under that $437 million. So I'm interested in sort of both the top-down uses of music by the military and the bottom-up uses of music by soldiers themselves, by the rank and file.
Right. And going back to music as a weapon, you alluded to something at the beginning of the book that really fascinated me, and I wanted to hear more about it. You mentioned that even in the Bible, there's mention of sonic weaponry. You mentioned something about Joshua's sonic assault on the city of Jericho. Can you tell us about that?
Well, I am not a biblical scholar, but the story of the in the Bible is that Joshua's troops basically bring down the walls of Jericho by blowing really loud trumpets at them. And so this was an example of the kind of sonic weaponry that I was hoping to find further explored and developed in the sort of more modern time. But there's this notion of music and power that goes back, millennia. It's in the Bible, as you suggested. The use of music by military troops to intimidate their enemies is something that we have documentation of, goes back through the early modern period, through the medieval period, and earlier. So just the I mean, we all have experiences that we can relate to where you hear really loud music and it's intimidating. It rocks your body. You feel it resonating in your chest. And so war drums, for example, were an example of a military technology, a military use of music that was intended to energize one's own troops, but also strike fear in the heart of one's enemies.
And you start the book talking pretty much about the Civil War. Is that where your research began for the most part? Or obviously, you went a little bit prior to that, but it seemed like the book Instrument of War begins talking about music in the Civil War.
Yeah, that's right. So the subject of music and war goes back to time immemorial. So the book doesn't start with, I mean, literally in the oldest history books and in ancient tombs, there are pictures of soldiers with musical instruments. In the oldest history books, there is record of armies and trumpets, armies and drums. But my focus is on the sort of more modern use of music in the military by the U.S. military since the Civil War, and there are a couple of reasons that I pick up there. One is, I mean, one of them was practical. I couldn't write the history of everything, but more pointedly, something new starts to happen in the 1860s in the U.S. And there's this really complex interrelationship between the military's use of music and the sort of concurrently growing music industries at the time. So in the Civil War, for example, you have this incredible need for musical instruments, for brass bands, and it's only because the US has this great industrial infrastructure that it can scale up during the war to supply enough instruments to the military to keep the bands playing in the war. So that's one thing. And then also the military starts to use music in a more systematic way than I'd seen previously. So although there's this history that dates back, essentially forever, something new starts to happen in the 1860s in the US, and it just grows in all these different directions from there. And so the book is organized around what we might call the major wars since then, from the Civil War to the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. And I sort of dedicate essentially a chapter per major war.
Another fascinating fact that I found in the book was that at the Gettysburg battle, there were 10 bands.
Yeah, another fact that like took me by surprise, and I was already kind of used to coming across a lot of this music.
And were these union bands? Was it mostly the more industrialized North that had most of the bands at the Battles of Gettysburg?
It was both the Union and the Confederacy. But you're right that the fact that the Union was more industrialized gave it more resources. And throughout the whole war, you see the Confederate music in the Confederate Army sort of being a smaller version of what there was in the Union Army. They didn't have as many musicians. Their army wasn't as big. They didn't have as many instruments available. So they had smaller bands with fewer instruments, but they did have bands as well. So it was both in the Battle of Gettysburg. And soldiers, just to be clear, there were 10 bands that were present. They weren't all playing. Some were playing. And Robert E. Lee has this guy visiting him, a military official from England, who's visiting during the Battle of Gettysburg. And he writes in his diary, in the middle of the battle, I should say, he says, "There was this incredible battle today. And at the height of the battle, it was really strange, but this band started playing all these waltzes." And so it wasn't just that they were present, they were in some cases playing while the bullets were flying and so on.
I think in the Jeff Daniels feature film called Gettysburg, they show Pickett's Charge, and I believe there was a band during Pickett's Charge. Is that fact-based?
That could be. There were a few instances of bands playing. There were certain military leaders whose regiments had bands that were playing during battles. So it wasn't only at Gettysburg. So that may be true. I'm not sure about the case of Pickett's Charge, but there were definitely other instances of uses of music in the Civil War in that respect. Sometimes they would play to intimidate the other side. Sometimes they played, but they also played at night. These military bands during the Civil War were a huge part of keeping soldiers' morale up when they weren't fighting at night, when they were, they had downtime basically, and to keep them from getting paralyzingly homesick and just sick and tired of being in the military, they would have concerts virtually every night to keep them going. And they weren't playing just military music. They were playing all kinds of popular music of the day to amuse soldiers and distract them. So just
Wow.
another aspect of how music was factoring into the Civil War when it wasn't being played during the battles.
And in your Vietnam chapter, which is called Demythologizing the Rock and Roll War, you talk about the importance of singing, especially during basic training, and we'll get to that in a second. But was there also a lot of singing amongst the troops during the Civil War?
Tons of singing. Singing is obviously the most flexible form of music making because you don't need any other instruments to do it. All you need is a voice. And so soldiers could sing anywhere, anytime. And it helped make military life a lot more bearable, particularly when doing really tedious things like marching from point A to point B. So there's a lot of singing that happens informally by soldiers to keep them amused. They are singing mostly songs of some of them sort of coming out of blackface minstrelsy. They might have been singing parlor songs. They might have been singing old traditional songs. But there was a lot of singing in the military. And the other thing about singing that I think is really important to understand is that it's something that soldiers could control themselves. Life in the military does not lend itself to soldiers having much autonomy. They can't control very much about their lives. You know, they don't control where they are, what they're doing, when they're sleeping, when they're waking up, what they're eating. All that stuff is under the control of the military. But singing is something that soldiers retained control over during the Civil War and in other conflicts as well. It's a small but meaningful thing that soldiers retain control over, you know, and it could carve out some little space of autonomy, some kind of like emotional, psychological space of their own, even within the circumstances of the war.
In case you're just joining us, this is Station Manager Ken filling in for Tectonic tonight, and my guest is David Sussman, Professor of History at the University of Delaware, and we're talking about his amazing new book, Instrument of War, Music and the Making of America's Soldiers. So, David, a fascinating part of the book was when you talk about the singing, especially during basic training during the Vietnam War, the Jody calls. And the Jody calls, I think listeners might recognize that from the movie Full Metal Jacket. I don't know, but I've been told. That's the idea of a Jody call. So tell us about the importance of Jody calls.
Jody calls, that sort of like sound off chanting, is a basic part of basic training. And it has multiple uses for the military in terms of coordinating soldiers' bodies, getting them to move together in time. In marching or running or whatever. And I'm sure most listeners are familiar with it. You know, if it's not from Full Metal Jacket, it's from, you know, throughout, it's saturating in popular culture, this motif, you know, from The Simpsons or SpongeBob SquarePants. There's like a riff on the Jody calls. But what is really interesting about it is it's a way that the military is using soldiers singing to help them or induce them, I should say, to basically discipline themselves, discipline their own bodies, to condition themselves to this kind of standardized movement directed by the military. And it is a form of expression that seems like a kind of folk culture, because it's informal, even within the most regimented parts of the military, basic training. You have this call and response exchange with like a drill sergeant who would call out something, and the soldiers would either repeat it or they would respond. And sometimes what they would be singing about would be how terrible the food was in the military. Or sometimes they would be singing about how great their unit was, their military unit. Sometimes they would chant nursery rhymes. I mean, they just had to, there were hours and hours to fill. And one of the ways that they did it was with these cadence calls, these Jody calls. And the way that they function is that they're trying to basically distract soldiers and keep them going through what's really arduous, really tedious exercise. And other times they would sing not just nursery rhymes or songs about the military, but they sang about the enemy. They sang about the weaponry. They sang about these kind of really heavily sexualized ideas about women and weapons and women and war. I came across in the context of the Vietnam chapter, this like subset of Jody calls about the dropping of napalm, for example. And they celebrate, and it's this kind of ghoulish humor celebrating how basically the violent destruction caused by napalm on people's bodies.
Right,
So,
they're chanting about how napalm sticks to children's bodies.
Yes,
So,
it sticks to kids.
an amazing aspect of the Jody calls is that it seems, it's all over popular culture, and it would seem to be a very, very important aspect of basic military training. And yet, you mention in the book that it's not mentioned anywhere in the training manuals. Is that right?
It's not. This is an interesting thing. So there's a manual that's written for drill instructors in the 1920s, and then it goes through a whole bunch of different editions up through the 1950s. And it's written by this military officer named Bernard Lentz, and he's the one who first has this idea that there could be this call and response that would be useful for the military in training soldiers' minds and bodies at the same time. He himself uses this language that soldiers participating in this call and response will be, as he puts it, disciplining themselves.
Well, obviously, the Jody calls were used to desensitize soldiers to the violence that they were expected to perform. And you mentioned that the non-fire rate. So, for example, during World War II, I guess it was a problem that they were finding that soldiers would not fire their weaponry even when they were under attack. And the Jody calls became a tool that the military used in order to get the non-fire rate down. Can you talk about that a bit?
So Bernard Lentz, just going back to him for a second, just to connect the dots here, he has this idea that this call and response is really good for training soldiers, but it's not really until World War II that this culture of chanting these riffs, these humorous, sometimes ghoulish, sometimes violent calls is brought into the use of these cadences, these Jody calls. It's not until World War II that they start to become kind of fun, as it were, considered by as such by the soldiers. They don't get really heavily sexualized, though, and it's not clear, probably not in World War II, but by Vietnam, they do. And they're a tool by which soldiers kind of learn to make fun of the violence that they're asked to do, forced to do as soldiers. Right after World War II, there was this famous report that found that there was a very, very high rate of soldiers not firing their weapons in battle. It was that they couldn't bring themselves to shoot their guns at other human beings, which is a very difficult, unnatural act.
Right,
And
that was portrayed by one of the characters in Saving Private Ryan.
right, exactly. Exactly. I mean, when you bring ordinary civilians into the military and ask them to do things like killing other people or putting their own lives at risk or watching their comrades in arms be killed or wounded, like that re is something that requires an incredible amount of emotional and psychological labor. It's really hard to get people to do that. And music is one of the things that helps them do that. So the non-fire rate was said to be very high in World War II. And when this report comes out after World War II, documenting this, the military is kind of up in arms. They're like, this is a huge problem. We can't have our soldiers going into battle and not firing their weapons at the enemies. And so one of the ways that these cadence calls, these Jodi calls work in Vietnam is to promote this kind of caricature of the enemy, caricature of, Viet Cong, Charlie, as it were, in these various rhymes, making fun of napalm, making fun of the murderous effects of these chemicals on people's bodies, and making light of them as a way of bonding the soldiers to one another, bonding them to the military, and but making it easier for them to pull the trigger when needed to do so in battle. And I should say too that, it's not like all soldiers were simply brainwashed by the chanting of cadences. It's not like they all necessarily believed that napalm was fun from the chanting, but it does make it easier. It does make it easier to kill people when they are dehumanized, when they are turned into caricatures. The effects of this seem borne out once soldiers go to Vietnam. And there are, we can talk about this later, but there are also pro-war songs in Vietnam, soldiers celebrating their exploits, celebrating again the effects of napalm, even when they're out of basic training and in country in the 1960s and 70s.
Another couple of aspects of the Vietnam War that we've seen portrayed in popular culture over and over again are the USO shows and radio during the war. So I wanted to ask you about USO. And you point out that the portrayal of the USO shows in movies is not really accurate as to what really happened with the USO shows. But the scale of them really surprised me. You mentioned that during the Vietnam War, there were 5,600 USO shows for the troops and 569 acts. And you mentioned, and I guess people always think about, people like James Brown or Marilyn Monroe performing for the troops. But you mentioned people like Raymond Burr, Connie Francis, Jean Mansfield, Jonathan Winters. As being some of the performers. You also point out Nancy Sinatra and Johnny Cash were there.
The USO shows were an attempt to amuse soldiers, to keep them on base so they would not go off and, find sex workers and stuff and go off and do drugs off base and this kind of thing. And there were a lot of these shows. They attempted to bring in A-list talent, but as you suggest, it was a lot of B-list and C-list, or people who by this time were B and C-list performers. James Brown was an interesting exception. One of the things that happens is that the military does not bring in a lot of African American artists, despite pressure from African American booking agents and soldiers themselves. So when James Brown famously tours the troops, that's a tour that he arranges himself outside of the USO. And he wants to go, and it's a kind of patriotic gesture for him to go to entertain the troops. But the fact that he's not sponsored by the USO is as telling about the shows that the USO was putting on as anything else.
We're talking to David Sussman about his riveting new book, Instrument of War, Music and the Making of America's Soldiers. David, let's talk about radio during the Vietnam War for a second. Also something that's been portrayed in a lot of movies. There was the American Forces Vietnam Network, the AFVN, and they produced a whole bunch of radio shows in Vietnam for the troops themselves. And one of them was called Dawn Buster, and that was portrayed in the Robin Williams movie Good Morning Vietnam. And the original disc jockey was Adrian Cronauer. Is that his name?
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But
He was
you
funny.
mentioned that at some point Pat Sajak was the host of Dawn Buster.
Yes.
That's pretty
So,
amazing.
Dawn Buster was a program that lasted for quite a number of years throughout the Vietnam War. But Adrian Cronauer, portrayed by Robin Williams in the movie, was only the host for a few years. And then there were a few other people, including Pat Sajak. And it's one of my problems with people's understanding about Vietnam is that I think it's really skewed by Hollywood. We have this sense of the Vietnam War being the rock and roll war. I'm going to argue that it wasn't really the rock and roll war that most people imagine, in part because of what they were listening to on Armed Forces radio, which they listened to a ton. And I'll get to the Dawnbuster show in a second, but soldiers in Vietnam had a lot of time on their hands. A lot of them were stationed on bases. They listened to radio for hours a day. The military had an interest in trying to figure out how much soldiers were listening to and what they were listening to, which programs and so forth. So they conducted numerous listener surveys, and they found, for example, that in 1968, 80% of GIs in Vietnam were listening to two or more hours of radio per day, and more than a third were listening to five or more hours a day. So they were listening to a ton of Armed Forces radio, AFVN.
And yeah, in the movie Apocalypse Now, I recall the Rolling Stones tune Satisfaction was used very prominently. But you mentioned in your book that Satisfaction was banned from AFVN stations. Is that right?
Yeah, it was seen as too, you know, sexually aggressive by some military officials. So one guy gets reassigned, one guy working for AFVN gets reassigned for playing Satisfaction.
Wow.
But the Dawnbuster show is an example of how different the reality was than the way it's portrayed in Hollywood. If you go and you watch Robin Williams, like, it seems like this really mad, anarchic show that had this compelling DJ who was kind of bouncing off the walls. But in fact, the real Adrian Cronauer was, as he later says, a lifelong card-carrying Republican. And the air checks that exist of his show when he was the Dawnbuster host, they're like, it's like dad jokes. It's not really funny. Yeah. And it's not that crazy. So it was relatively tame, and it's really embellished and made much more interesting in the movie than it was in real life. And the stuff that they were listening to, the stuff that he was playing, was really middle of the road music. It was a ton of top 40 pop. And this is true for other programs on AFVN as well. It was top 40 pop. It was oldies. It was not the rock soundtrack that we associate with Vietnam from Apocalypse Now or Full Metal Jacket or any of the other movies, all of which are saturated with rock music. Oh, you know, right down to like Forrest Gump or whatever. All these movies have a ton of rock music, which is not what AFVN was playing, with one exception. And that was that for a few years, they did have a show that was supposed to be their underground show called Sergeant Pepper. and for 90 minutes a week, soldiers could hear stuff like Cream or the Beatles' White Album or something like that. But it was just for 90 minutes once a week on Sundays, whereas the rest of the week for years, what soldiers were listening to was really middle-of-the-road stuff.
And you talk about the importance of country and Western music as well as soul and R&B during the war, and you talk about jukeboxes and the importance of jukeboxes, I guess, in some of the clubs and stuff. You mentioned one incident where there was a fight between the black troops and the white troops over a jukebox. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, what I found was that the relationship between soul music and country music, that's where the friction was. It wasn't around rock. And there was a lot of country music on the radio as well. And there was a lot of country music in the bins of the post-exchange stores where soldiers could buy records and hi-fi equipment and lots of other American goods. It was on the jukeboxes, country music was. And the black troops were resentful of the fact that although they made up a disproportionate number of the soldiers drafted in Vietnam, and they made up a disproportionate number of the combat troops, and they were underrepresented among the officers, their music, the music they preferred by black artists, was almost invisible, almost inaudible, invisible. There was very little of it on the radio, with the exception of like Motown stuff. And so they were very resentful. And there was in 1966, there's a riot that breaks out over whether or not soldiers are going to listen to soul music or country music on the jukebox. And in the years following, there were similar riots around Vietnam and other military bases, and actually at U.S. bases in other parts of the world as well. So this is where there was real friction, the country music fans versus the soul music fans. And the military was very concerned about this, because this kind of, you know, this was not trivial. What soldiers' musical preferences were corresponded to really deep social and political divisions in the military. And so they conduct inquiries, they send out investigators to find out what's going on, and ultimately they end up doing things. They make some concessions, like they start to stock more soul records in the PX stores, but the you still don't hear much music by black artists on Armed Forces radio, for example. And that is reflective of this kind of deep social division in the military.
And there's a really interesting segment in the book about how the country music industry out of Nashville exploited country music during the Vietnam War. And that was when it happened, that country music became like the hyper-patriotic music of America.
Yes. So the military has this like deep relationship with Nashville. It's not just country music. It's Nashville. It's the Nashville country music industry. And it goes back to the like 1950s. And here I want to make a shout out to a great new book that came out by the historian Joseph Thompson called Cold War Country. Goes really deep into exploring how in the 1950s, when rock and roll was on the rise, the country music industry in Nashville was looking for new markets. It was worried about its declining markets in relation to the competition from rock and roll. And the military was looking to become more appealing to soldiers, trying to up its image. And so there's this way that they start to use country music in their advertising. They start to take soldiers who get recruited, who are country music artists or who become country music artists, and they tour around military bases. They tour around off military bases in the popular culture. And there's this really close relationship that develops that leads to these associations between military music and or military life and country music. Obviously, those are associations that don't go away after Vietnam. In many ways, they are still very much around today. There's still a very strong association between country music and, you know, sort of new country and a really unrestrained patriotism or unrestrained nationalism. And they're interwoven. And we see this on the airwaves. We see this in the records that are available to soldiers in Vietnam and so on. It's really not coincidence that there's so much country music in Vietnam.
We're talking to David Sussman about his new book, Instrument of War. This is station manager Ken filling in for Mark Hurst on Tectonic. We've been talking about music during the Vietnam War, but let's move on now into the 1990s. And your chapter on that begins with the infamous incident when the U.S. invaded Panama, and Manuel Noriega, I think, was holed up in his official residence, and the U.S. troops famously were blasting music at him. I remember reading at the time that they were playing the Bobby Fuller Five, I Fought the Law and the Law Won. You mentioned, I think, a Kenny Loggins tune. You also mentioned Ride of the Valkyries. So that wasn't really music as a weapon. What were they trying to do there? Just annoy him? Keep him from sleeping? What was that all about?
They were trying to annoy him and break him down, and also through high volume, make it difficult for him to communicate, to continue to operate as the operator that he was. And so it was about trying to disrupt and also intimidate and demoralize. And eventually he does give himself up. And that's the end of, you know, the end of the first kind of instance of, it was a psyops operation. It was a psychological operations initiative to set up these speakers outside of the residence where he was holed up, and to just bombard him with really loud music. And it worked, and it's not the last time that the military will do that.
And Ride of the Valkyries, that was famously portrayed as being blasted from the helicopters in Apocalypse Now during the Robert Duvall scene. Was that fact-based?
The Apocalypse Now scene?
Yeah.
No, it wasn't, but they did blast sound at the jungles during Vietnam. There's this great tape. I should find it for you, Ken. I think you'd really like it.
Oh, I think I've heard this.
Yeah, it's this really weird psychedelic recording that it was blasted at the jungles of Vietnam. It's this sort of ghostly voices that were supposed to imitate the sounds of the dead, the spirits of the Vietnamese dead calling out to Vietnamese in the jungle, telling them to surrender. And it's intermixed with kind of electronic music and animal sounds that were all supposed to kind of just, you know, creep out the Vietnamese.
Yeah.
That actually, I believe, was used. And the record shows that was used in Vietnam. The Ride of the Valkyries, not so much. That was an embellishment, as far as I know.
So that was a fiction in Apocalypse Now, but then it came to actually be used by the troops in Panama in the 1990s. And then you talk about it being used during the Iraq War, during the battles of Fallujah, where American troops were blasting it as they rolled their tanks through the streets. And in fact, you even mentioned that some of the troops were referring to the Second Battle of Fallujah because of the music as Lollapalooza.
Yeah. So it's crazy, but there is a lot of music in the Iraq War. Some of it is this life imitating art, you know, the life imitating the soldiers who would watch Apocalypse Now, who would watch that scene to get psyched up, would then take these recordings and blast them from speakers that they mounted on top of their Humvees, where normally you'd have like a gun turret. Some of the Humvees were outfitted with loudspeakers that they would blast at local populations in Iraq to intimidate them, to try to freak them out, to annoy them, to try to destabilize them, to try to prevent them from sleeping. In some cases, just, you know, people need sleep, and trying to prevent them from getting a good night's sleep was part of the effect. And the playlists include not just Ride of the Valkyries, but also lots of heavy metal and hard rock and in some cases hip hop, just sort of like AC/DC, but also Drowning Pool. The song Bodies was a really big song in Iraq. Over and over again, soldiers talk about the popularity of that song, Bodies, among soldiers. And so they would blast this at local populations in Iraq as a way of annoying them. And a lot of the lyrics were sort of militant or violent, like the AC/DC song Shoot to Thrill. It's got lyrics about, you know, killing and it using, you know, guns and stuff. And, you know, it's a great song. As a song, in other contexts, here it's used as an instrument of intimidation. Now, whether or not the local Iraqis made anything of the lyrics is unlikely. They were, even if they heard this, even if they could make out the lyrics, they would be, they probably were not English speakers and probably wouldn't have known that the songs were about shooting and killing and so forth. But they did have the effect of really charging up the US troops. That is one thing that they definitely did. Soldiers report how they would get really amped up listening to this kind of music when they went out before and during missions, when they were out on patrol or when they were out on missions.
And it was during the Second Iraq War that music, or at least in the news and mainstream media, that we started hearing about music being used as a form of torture, or I guess what was referred to as enhanced interrogation techniques or no-touch torture. Was that sanctioned? Was that officially sanctioned as a technique?
It was. There were later the military officials kind of reversed their position on it, and they later by 2010 or so have disavowed this kind of technique. But it was, and it was it, one of the crazy things about use of music as a form of torture to break down the will, break down the psyches of detainees. One of the crazy things about that is that it was initially developed as a technique to train Americans to withstand their own interrogation were they caught back during the Korean War and in the 1950s. So they were training soldiers who might be captured and teaching them how to withstand that. And so they would torture them basically and say, this is what you need to be prepared for. And then later, that technique, which was effectively developed as a kind of defensive mechanism for US soldiers, is turned on its head and used as an offensive technique for detainees at, prison sites in Iraq, Afghanistan, or black site prisons, or Guantanamo, or whatever.
And
So, yeah.
you mentioned that when it was a recommended method of torture, you were not supposed to exceed 90 decibels. Is that correct?
Yeah, but those guidelines I think were really fictive.
Yeah,
I don't th
how do you know whether you're at 90 decibels or 110 decibels?
Yeah, and that it could be, and it was not just the num the decibels, but also for how much time you were supposed to be bombarding somebody with sound. The only thing that was really a limitation was that the sound blasted at detainees in these prisons was also audible to the prison keepers, to the soldiers who were doing the interrogations. So they had to listen to all this stuff as well. And
Right.
I think they had, limited tolerance eventually.
Because the people, because the prisoners who were being tortured with extremely loud music, they didn't put headphones on them, right? They blasted them with speakers so they could feel it through that throughout their entire body.
Yes. I mean, they did this a lot and it wasn't totally standardized. So there were instances when they did use headphones, but mostly it was really loud music blasted audibly so it would affect their bodies. And the soldiers did this. I mean, one of the technological innovations that makes this possible is the repeat function on CD players that they were using or MP3 players that they were using, because you could just keep going over and over again. And detainees who are interviewed after they are released report on how this would just break them down. And they considered this sonic fault. They didn't actually even care that much about what was being played. It was the physical effect of the sound, it was repetitive effect of the sound. And then sometimes it would just stop without any kind of warning. And that make them feel like they had, one of them says it was like the feeling that somebody had stopped pummeling him with fists. It's that intense.
So typically with sonic torture of this type, they would play one song on repeat at extremely high volume, and they would play it for how many hours?
It could be a few hours, it could be 12 hours. It depended on the interrogator, what they how they thought it was working, if they wanted to use the fact that they had the power to change the the sound at any second. That was another form of disempowerment for the detainees, which is that they were subject to the will, the arbitrary will of the interrogators. The interrogators could decide, okay, we're just going to listen to the Meow Mix theme for the next 4 hours.
Was that actually, was the Meow Mix theme used also?
Yeah, that was one of them.
Wow.
Yeah.
Right, and then they used the Barney. They used the Barney theme song, right?
Exactly, exactly, yeah. So, you know, really annoying songs, really annoying jingles, and the power to decide when to start and stop that was a huge part of that power that interrogators had over detainees. And that was combined with other forms of torture, other quote-unquote enhanced interrogation techniques, like light and controlling the light, you know, making soldiers live in the darkness, or bombarding them with bright lights, or bombarding them with like strobe lights, or temperatures, forcing them to live in really hot or really cold rooms. And so this was sort of, the sound was a part of this kind of multi-sensory assault that the interrogators used to break down prisoners.
So we're almost out of time. We have about 8 minutes left. We've been talking to David Sussman about his fascinating new book, Instrument of War, Music, and the Making of America's Soldiers. David, I was hoping we could end the show kind of with a technology lightning round. And I could mention a couple of different music formats, and you could just tell me if or how they were used since the 1860s in the military. Edison cylinders.
No.
Really? Edison,
yeah, Edison cylinders, they didn't travel that well.
There were
cylinder, phonographs, flat phonograph discs definitely were used in World War I.
Okay. And when did recordings start to be used and how?
In World War I, soldiers start to have phonographs in what would later be called enlisted men's clubs. They all had phonographs. They all had pianos. Soldiers often also had them in the in the trenches, and they would take up collections, or they would ask their families to pitch in to buy a phonograph to send to the troops overseas. That starts in World War I.
And how about troops recording audio letters for their friends and family at home? Did that take place at all?
During Vietnam, because obviously the capacity, the technological capacity to make recordings is different than the capacity to listen to pre-recorded records. And so tapes and audio letters become an important thing in Vietnam when soldiers have reel-to-reel tapes. They could buy this hi-fi equipment at the post exchange stores. Sometimes they were buying cutting edge hi-fi equipment that wasn't even available in the U.S. yet. And they were also among the early adopters of cassettes.
Right. You mentioned that in the Vietnam War, starting in 71, there was actually cassette trading going on amongst the troops.
Yeah. Yeah. And they would trade, obviously they weren't trading letters. They would trade records and they would trade cassettes of new records that were coming out, or somebody would, you know, record their favorite radio station in the U.S. and send some air check tape to somebody in Vietnam. And then people would listen to it, be like, oh, my God, it makes me feel like I'm at home. And then they would duplicate that and share those with other people.
And we talked about radio during the Vietnam War, but was radio used at all in wars prior to Vietnam?
Armed Forces radio starts during the Second World War. And it's really an amazingly complex technological achievement. It's the first worldwide radio network. And that requires a lot of complicated coordination, because it's not just like you have one big, super powerful transmitter in the U.S. that's blasting, that's broadcasting around the world. It's a lot of transcription discs of radio programs that are then broadcast asynchronously in different parts of the world. So you would have had the same programs, but broadcast at different times in Europe or in the Pacific or in the China, Burma, India theater or whatever. So radio starts to be an important factor as early as World War II.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The golden age of radio.
And how about compact discs?
Compact discs in Iraq and Afghanistan, particularly Iraq. One of the things that's really interesting about the Iraq War is that it coincides exactly with the popularization of the iPod. So the first soldiers to go to Iraq, they're all bringing music with them, and they're bringing Discman players. And then the iPod starts to get popular, and then they all immediately shift to iPods because they hold so much more music. They're also more stable. You know, you can shake an iPod and it won't skip. So the iPods become really popular really fast. And if I have time for a quick anecdote, there's a guy who writes a memoir shortly after this named Colby Buzzell, who talks about this popularity of the iPod, and he's trying to explain to readers how cool this was, that not only could you have all this music, but you could organize it in these custom playlists. And it's so new that he has to explain the concept of playlists to his readers. And you know, reading this, you're reminded of what an innovation that was at the time. But it allows soldiers in Iraq to form to make these like psych up playlists that they would listen to before going out on patrol, and having a different playlist that they would then listen to when they came back from patrol and needed to relax and chill out. So they would have the cool down playlist, and that had stuff, some of it which was really surprising. It would have your you know, instead of Drowning Pool, it would be Dave Matthews Band or Diana Krall or all kinds of much less amped up artists.
Yeah, and then you also mentioned that they would make intimidation playlists, right, for rolling through the streets to play to the local population.
Yes, that was another use of the playlist technology. So thinking about music, you know, this is obviously a show about technology, and one of the things that I was so fascinated by in working on this project was how many different technologies were involved. And I also end up making an argument too in the book that music itself is used as a technology by the military. If you think about technology is not just hardware, but it's how things are made and done. That's a definition that historians of technology like to use sometimes. And music is one of the ways that war was made. Making war was enabled by music. And so in this sense, in the training of soldiers and keeping their morale going, it is one of the tools that the military has to make war. And so we have like these different individual technologies, Discmans or iPods or whatever, but it's also music itself that's functioning as a kind of technology.
Well, it's a fascinating book, whether you hate war or love war. It's called Instrument of War: Music and the Making of America's Soldiers by David Sussman, who's been our guest this past hour. And David, how can people get the book without going through Amazon?
They can go to my website, which is davidsussman.net, and there are links to buying it from the publisher or buying it from an independent bookseller as well. On the website, there's also an audio-visual companion to the book, so people can find sounds and a few additional images that I talk about in the book.
I just wanted to spell the website. It's David Sussman, Sussman.net. David, thanks so much for being on Tectonic tonight.
Thank you, Ken.
This is WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope in New York City and Rockland County at 91.9 FM and online at WFMU.org. Mark Hurst returns next week. Please stay tuned for It's Complicated with Dave Mandel. And I have 2 minutes left, and as much as I'm tempted to throw on the Cars for Kids jingle, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to mention that Mark does return next week with another episode talking about the Starlink satellites that are about to fall to Earth. And Mark also wanted me to mention that he's planning a big Thanksgiving episode of Tectonic for November 25th. And he would like listener participation in that. He would like listeners to send him something in writing or something audio based about the technology that you are most thankful for. For me, I know I'm thankful for winches, bilge pumps, toilets, and that would be dumb toilets, not smart toilets. Especially those moments when there's no electricity and your toilet will still work as long as you can find water to throw in the upper tank. Baking soda and vinegar bombs and other party tricks involving baking soda and vinegar. And tennis ball lighter fluid tin can cannons. Those are the technologies that I am most thankful for. Mark would like you to send him an email with the technology that you are thankful for to Mark, M-A-R-K, at WFMU.org with your answer either written in the body of the email or as an audio recording. And if you are going to be sending an audio for the technology that you're thankful for, please keep it to a minute. And please mention if you would like to be totally anonymous. I've already done the legal ID. Coming up next, it is It's Complicated with Dave Mandel.
Welcome, folks, to another installment of It's Complicated, an hour of prog and prog-adjacent music. I'm your host, Dave Mandel. I'm here every Monday at this time. That would be 7 to 8 p.m. Hold on while I get my playlist going here on the website. Beautiful. Thanks for joining me. A lot of exciting music for you tonight, as you would expect, I hope. And we're going to start with some German music. We're going to hear a guy named Adalbert von Dayen, and he recorded for Sky Records, the Sky label, which was a notable, I guess, krautrock label that featured among its members, signees, the band Cluster, various other major krautrock acts. And again, we're going to hear from Adalbert von Dayen. This is going to be a track from a 1980 release called Atmosphere. And it'll be, there's a two-part title track, Atmosphere Part 1, Atmosphere Part 2. We're going to hear Atmosphere Part 1. I would say this leans to the electronic end of the prog spectrum. Some Tangerine Dream in there, maybe, some Pink Floyd. Well, you decide. Here we go. This is music from Adalbert von Dayen.
Thank you.